Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS, FM, and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Our subject today is, well, it's the second time we're going to talk about modern warfare. This time we're going to talk not about cyber weapons, but about drones. You've heard of them. I think they're actually called unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs, or sometimes remotely piloted vehicles. Whatever name you give them, you know what we're talking about. We're talking about planes that fly around without pilots, at least without pilots being in the planes, and surveil, spy on people with remarkable accuracy from way up in the air and altitudes where they can't even be detected by people on the ground, and who occasionally, every now and then, launch weapons at people on the ground with devastating results, depending on your perspective, devastatingly good or devastatingly bad, and sometimes including something we euphemistically refer to as collateral damage. Drones have been much in the news lately. They have been the subject of great controversy. And of course, there's a big constitutional issue as to who controls these drones and who makes the decisions about how they are going to be used. Is this a war issue? Is this something Congress needs to be involved in? Is Congress involved in it? Lots and lots of questions, lots and lots of concerns. And to discuss this with me, I'm going to have Scott Shane, a national defense, national security reporter for the New York Times, who's written extensively on this subject. And I'm looking forward to speaking to him. But before we do that, let me introduce a special guest I have with me. Hello, Ben.
Hey, Dad.
Ben Harris. Young Ben Harris is now making his third appearance on your weekly Constitutional. And this one's at my special... he's telling me now he's... How many is it? This is your fourth appearance? Oh, that's right. You had an extra show there. At any rate, Ben Harris is coming back again. Why are we bringing him on? Well, part of it, of course, is that he's my kid, and I'm proud of him. He has just been recently selected as a Jefferson Scholar at the University of Virginia, where he'll be starting this fall of 2012. And he's a very good researcher, very smart young man who's interested in all sorts of constitutional issues. And so that's one reason to have him on so frequently. But the other reason is because, like all members of his generation, he has wasted, it seemed to his mother and me, innumerable hours staring at the television set, staring at video screens, manipulating some little control device, I think. He calls it a PS something or other, and shooting missiles and bombs at various people. Of course, parents think these things are a complete waste of time, but it turns out that those sorts of skills are precisely the sorts of skills that are used by the people who remotely pilot these drones, aren't they?
Kind of. Well, you know Reapers are effective because they take 9 kills to get after all.
I see. Okay. At any rate, Ben has some expertise with this sort of thing, and Ben is going to tell us all about drones, and specifically he's going to tell us about some history that may be relevant to our discussion of drones. But that'll come later. In the meantime, let's go and talk with Scott Shane, the national security reporter for the New York Times, and see what he has to tell us about drones. Well, Scott Shane from the New York Times, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. Now, I recently noticed an excellent piece you did. Well, you do a lot of excellent pieces on national security law, but I noticed one you did on drone strikes and how controversial they've become and that they've got both their detractors and their proponents. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how drones are used and what the pros and cons are.
Sure. Well, I guess the first thing to say is that most of these drones or UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, as they're called, are used for surveillance and not for, killing. But starting in 2000, after spotting bin Laden from a Predator drone that was being flown over Afghanistan, folks in the CIA and the military started talking about, could we arm the drone, put missiles on the drones? And part of that was because when they spotted bin Laden, there was already an order that allowed the government to kill him if he came into their sights, but it would. They basically said it would take 6 hours to organize a cruise missile strike, and by then, you know, who knows where he would be. They had taken a shot at him with a cruise missile in 1998 after the bombings in East Africa of the embassies, and he was gone by the time the missiles landed. So, so they began to look at putting missiles on the Predators, and pretty quickly that started to happen, and certainly 9/11 came along. The year after they'd first started thinking about this, and certainly accelerated things. And there was a strike in 2002 in the desert in Yemen that hit a car of people crossing the desert, one of whom happened to be, turned out to be an American citizen.
Ouch.
He was not the target. But and then from there it sort of escalated. There's most of the strikes have been in Pakistan, carried out by the CIA, but there have been quite a few strikes in Yemen, carried out by both the military and the CIA, and a few in Somalia.
Wow, so these things were originally designed to be small, lightweight, unmanned vehicles that, because they were so small and because of the way they were designed, could go up and stay up for long periods of time and do surveillance, right?
That's right, even in the last 10 years, the surveillance capabilities, not surprisingly, if you look at, you know, what's happened to cell phones in the same period, has gotten much better, and now they say that they, you know, have pretty remarkable video images that come back to a base from these craft. They get a real good look at what they're shooting at.
Yeah, and it's remarkable too that they fly so high and they're so quiet that most of the time people cannot tell that they're being observed, can they?
Yeah, sometimes in the tribal areas and other places where there are a lot of drones, they'll sometimes hear them. They kind of sound like a flying lawnmower.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they actually are given a name in Pakistan of wasps because they kind of buzz around. Sometimes them, there's a stealth drone that sort of crash landing in Iran that flies extremely high, 50,000 feet and more, and is sort of given special paint and so on to make it more or less invisible to radar, so they can be very stealthy as well.
Okay, so you've got these remarkably capable vehicles that are difficult to detect one way or the other, that now have these remarkable surveillance capabilities and have the strike capability as well. Now, of course, this seems to really be entering a new phase of warfare, one that's, constitutionally very troubling because, of course, as you point out, they're not even always operated by the military, are they?
Yeah, there's a whole series of legal questions that have arisen. One is this sort of merger almost of or blurring of the lines between the CIA and the military. So you have a civilian intelligence agency that for 10 years, but particularly the drone strikes in Pakistan have increased since 2008. So for 4 years has waged, you know, what by any, historical standards is a sort of major military campaign. And you know better than I do that there are distinctions between the uniformed military and the civilians who run the CIA in terms of international law and the law of war. And then there are questions of sovereignty of the country where this stuff is happening. You know, we're used to, in conventional terms, going to war in a country, and everybody's clear we were at war in Iraq. We are at war in Afghanistan. But we're not at war in Pakistan. We're not at war in Yemen. We're not at war in Somalia, and yet our CIA and military are killing people there. So that's sort of another set of questions. And then
Before we leave that, I do want to get to the last point you're going to make, but do we have permission from all of these sovereign nations to be doing what we're doing there?
Well, that question is a little bit complicated. In Pakistan, certainly, from what we were told by American officials and in some cases Pakistani officials, there was a kind of quiet agreement that they would allow these strikes to take place on their territory, and in some cases would provide intelligence to guide the strikes. And in some cases, we obliged them by hitting people who were really probably more of a threat to Pakistan than to the United States. The group called the Pakistani Taliban, or known by its initials TTP, being an example of people who we hit. Certainly, they could be argued to pose a threat of terrorism to the U.S. or certainly to American troops in Afghanistan. But their real target was the Pakistani government, Pakistani army. But what complicated things was that the Pakistani officials sort of reserved the right to denounce these strikes in public while they were assisting them in private. Mm. And so there was this sort of double game that was going on for some years. And then, you know, some things happened that really did offend the Pakistani authorities, and public opinions turned strongly against the drone strikes in Pakistan. And, you know, more recently, the Pakistani parliament has voted to ban drone strikes from the whole territory of the country. So, you know, whether we have permission or not now is, you know, something that I suppose the lawyers would have to sort out. In Yemen, there was sort of a similar double game going on that became public when all those diplomatic cables that were obtained by the WikiLeaks organization were made public. Mm-hmm. And the former president of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, was quoted in one of those memos, one of those diplomatic cables, as telling General David Petraeus when he was visiting, we will, you know, don't worry, we'll keep saying that this, that your strikes are actually being carried out by us. In other words, that the American strikes are actually Yemeni strikes. And one of Saleh's aides piped up and said, oh, yeah, I just lied to the parliament about that.
Oh, boy.
So there, too, you had this sort of public and private game going on. You know, even answering the question of whether we have permission of a country, I think in some of these instances might be a little bit complicated.
It sounds like it. Speaking of permission, does the president, of course, who's ultimately in charge of the CIA, does he have the permission of Congress to be doing this? Because, of course, that's where the issues of war and peace come in. If this looks awfully like war, and as you know, it's Congress's province to declare war or not, is the Congress going along with this, or is the president doing this unilaterally?
Congress is going along with this. The as I said, most of the strikes have been in Pakistan, the largest number have been in Pakistan, and that's carried out by the CIA as a covert action program, and that requires both a presidential finding, it's called a presidential statement authorizing it, and it also requires notification to the House and Senate Intelligence Committees. And we're told that that those committees are briefed after each strike, and, you know, often those committees complain that that an administration is not keeping them up to speed on things. But in this case, they, you know, both Republicans and Democrats, I think, feel pretty well informed about these strikes. And given how few things get bipartisan support in Congress these days, I think it's interesting that the that both Democrats and Republicans have generally supported these drone strikes. There's been very little criticism. Partly, of course, they're classified programs, and members of Congress aren't really able to debate them publicly, but even privately, there's been very little criticism. So I think it's probably fair to say that Congress likes this, and I think it's also not hard to tell why they like it. You know, we invaded Afghanistan, we invaded Iraq, 100,000 troops for 10 years, lots of casualties, lots of American casualties, many, many civilian casualties in among Iraqis and Afghans. And the outcome, you know, in both cases is somewhat mixed. By comparison, what we've done in Pakistan by hitting people we consider to be a danger, you know, it's just the scale is much, much smaller. You know, the number of deaths is much, much smaller, and the risk of the U.S. forces is almost zero. So so you can see why that would be an appealing thing to members of Congress, no matter which way they lean.
Sure, but as you mentioned, because all of this has been done in secrecy, at least until people like you have brought it to the attention of the public, there has not been an open public congressional debate on this. Certainly there's been no public declaration that this is going to be the policy of the United States. Does that trouble you at all, that this has not been something that we debated at least before we started doing it?
Well, I mean, I'm a reporter, so I think everything should be public, and of course that troubles me, but... But, I mean, there has been, I would say that there's been some recognition by the government that when things start blowing up on the ground, it's hard to call them secret. And so they, government officials have been willing to share a certain amount of information with reporters about this stuff. And the administration has offered a glimpse of the legal reasoning in a series of public talks by the legal advisor to the State Department, by the general counsel of the Defense Department, the general counsel of CIA, John Brennan, the president's counterterrorism advisor. They've all given speeches on this topic, and they dance around some of the details, but they basically try to lay out some of the legal rationale for what they're doing.
And could you summarize that for us, at least as much as you've been exposed to?
Well, I think the quick summary would be that there are two justifications for this. One is under the authorization for the use of military force against Al-Qaeda and its allies. It was passed after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be sort of congressionally approved use of force against an enemy. And then on top of that, they also claim the right to self-defense under international law, the right that if someone is about to, launch an attack, or you believe that someone's about to launch an attack against the United States, that you have a right under the under international law to take action against them. And so that's been the basic legal rationale. And then they have explained that, principles like proportionality, meaning that the damage you're doing to the other side in terms of civilian casualties and so on has to be proportional to the threat. And distinction, trying to distinguish between the combatants and the non-combatants, the civilians, all that has been laid out in these speeches to one degree or another.
Yeah, that proportionality argument is, of course, reminds me of the piece you just did for the Times, people saying that this is actually humane and is preferable to traditional warfare. I wonder if you could expand on that a little bit. These policies obviously have lots of defenders. Do you find that those are persuasive arguments, that this really is better than just sending the troops in?
Well, sending the troops in is so costly in every term, in every sense of that word, in terms of the commitment you're making, that you may kid yourself and think, well, we'll be out of there in a year. But Iraq and Afghanistan show you that generally does not happen. The costs in human lives, the costs in the economic costs are just so colossal, $1 trillion for those wars, more than $1 trillion now, when you compare drones to that kind of, if that's what you're comparing it to, then it certainly makes drones look, by comparison, far more precise and targeted. But I think it's a new technology and it's being used in new ways, and there are lots of unanswered questions, and sort of the law of unintended consequences certainly comes into play. I mean, on the one hand, you can certainly say that if your goal is to kill terrorists who are plotting against the United States, it certainly seems that drones would be a far more efficient safer way to do it than invading a country.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're talking with Scott Shane of the New York Times about drones or unmanned aerial vehicles. After the break, we'll have our Constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Scott Shane. Stay tuned. I'm here with Kelly Carmichael from James Madison's Montpelier, and it's time for the Constitutional Quiz. Kelly, are you ready?
I am ready.
I feel like a woman today. I feel like a natural woman. You know what really gets me?
If you start singing right now, I may have to leave.
You make
oh my
me
goodness.
Feel.
Oh, no. I don't know if you you're allowed to sing on radio.
I don't think I'm allowed. I think the FCC prohibits it, so I'll stop now. No, but one of the things that I have only recently realized is that our constitutional quiz is almost always men.
They are.
Have you noticed that?
I do notice that.
We don't discriminate against women. In fact, now that we finally, I think, have a woman on the line, I'm really kind of psyched up about this. And I want to take this opportunity to encourage our female listeners to volunteer. You can go to our Facebook page. You can leave us a message. You can post. You can be on our next batch of quizzes. And I really hope that you will. And we encourage women. We love women on your weekly Constitutional. So which woman do we have on the line today?
You have Katie from Logan, West Virginia.
Katie from Logan, West Virginia. So happy to have you, Katie. Now, where is Logan?
It is in the southern part of West Virginia.
Is it near anything?
No, not really.
Near some mountains? Okay.
Yeah, near some mountains. We
have a Walmart. Do you have a stoplight?
Yes, we have a stoplight.
Yeah, okay. A stoplight and a Walmart. And, of course, like all of West Virginia, it's near to heaven.
Yes, exactly.
All right, Katie. Thanks so much for playing. And, Kelly, do you have a question for Katie today?
I do, Katie. I'm going to read you a quote from Adlai Stevenson, and you're going to answer whether the statement that I read addresses certain principles. All right?
Okay.
All right, here's the quote. As citizens of this democracy, you are the rulers and the ruled, the lawgivers and the law-abiding, and the beginning and the end. The statement that I just read addresses what principle? A, equal protection. B, rule of law. C, popular sovereignty. Or D, civil rights.
Okay, that's while Katie's thinking.
What was they again?
Yeah, just a second. We'll get, what were you asking?
I was asking what was C again.
C was popular sovereignty.
Okay.
Now, you're taking notes, and we're going to let Katie think a little bit. We'll go back over these in a second, but in the meantime, I'll just interject. Now, Adlai Stevenson was the two-time Democratic presidential candidate in the 1950s. He ran and lost against Dwight Eisenhower. Talk about a hard guy to run against.
Sure.
Well, I'm going to run against the guy that saved Western civilization and led the troops on D-Day. Okay. But he was often noted as being a very well-spoken, a very thoughtful, a very learned man, and he had a sense of humor as well. So that's why we're picking him as a good source for the quote. So could you read the quote again, Kelly, and
sure
then we'll go
thing.
Over each of these one by one.
All right. Katie, the quote again is, as citizens of this democracy, you are the rulers and the ruled, the lawgivers and the law-abiding, and the beginning and the end.
And what are the choices? What is that?
Your answer choice A, does this statement address the principle of A, equal protection?
Does that statement make you think of equal protection, Katie?
Not really. I'm not really sure what it makes me think of, but I don't think it's equal protection.
Okay, well, he didn't say anything about equality. I understand
no.
that. Okay, well, then maybe not A, but what about B?
B, rule of law.
Does it make you think about the rule of law?
Well, it makes me think a little bit about the rule of law because it was talking about, you know, we are the lawgivers. So at least law's in there. So.
We got some law in there. So maybe
the rulers and the ruled.
That's right. Yeah. Maybe it's B. Okay. Well, what about, what's the next one? What's C?
C is popular sovereignty.
What about that one? Popular sovereignty.
It's not popping out to me. I don't love it.
He doesn't love it. All right. Okay. No popular sovereignty. Then what about D?
D is civil rights.
Civil rights. Does it make you think of civil rights, Katie?
Maybe.
You are...
Can I find a friend?
Sorry, you're on the phone. You are the friend.
You are our friend.
Sorry, you're our friend today, so we're looking to you for this answer. Are you not loving any of these answer choices?
No.
Well, you got to pick one.
I'm just going to guess. I know that I should go with C, but because I feel like that's always...
Where did this idea come from?
I don't know. Well,
what is C again? What is C?
Popular sovereignty.
You're going to pick C just because you like C?
I don't like it at all, but I feel like that should be the answer by default. It's always C if you don't know it.
I like
but
hearing I everyone's rationalization of how they do multiple choice
when
tests.
When I was a kid, we always said choose D. That was always our default, but I guess it's a generational thing.
When I was a
kid,
it was B or C, usually leaning to C. But
okay, all right.
Yeah. Well, which one would you choose?
No, I can't. I'll tell you right after you make your final choice. We'll do that then.
Okay, well, I'm going to guess, and I'm just going to say B, as in boy.
Wait a second. I thought you were going to choose C.
I should choose C, but I changed it because of the quote where it has rule in it and law actually in the quote somewhere.
Okay. Okay.
Do you think I should change back to C?
I think you should do whatever you think you should do, Katie.
Oh,
you are a grown woman.
I'm going to stick with B.
With B as in boy?
B as in rule of law.
Final answer?
Oh, I guess, yes.
Kelly?
Katie, you should have stuck with C.
She had it.
Popular sovereignty.
Popular.
We're gonna have to make sure that we don't have C answers from
No, you know what, Kelly? You know what, Katie? Is that Kelly messed you up? She pointed out that there was rule in there, and
that was me.
This
time. Usually you do this,
usually,
but this time it was me. I'm sorry, Katie. I wasn't very fair.
When she said that,
I thought she was like giving me. Giving me the
answer. No, we usually just try to trick you up.
Kelly's
we don't actually try to help.
Oh no, Kelly's actually a very mean person. I've discerned
evil.
She's evil. She's downright evil. You should see her sometime. The quote is about how we are our own rulers, that we make the laws that we have to obey, and that really does encapsulate what we call popular sovereignty. Popular simply means of the people. And sovereignty means, the ultimate government power. And as, to 21st century Americans especially, that notion just seems, to borrow a phrase, self-evident. I mean, we take it for granted that, of course, we rule ourselves. But up until the American Revolution, the late 18th century, that was very much the exception and not the rule. Most societies throughout history have been authoritarian societies of one type or another. And we actually have a term for it. We call, at least in the North America, we call it the American experiment. Whether a people can come together and design a government and rule themselves without some authoritarian figure. And it's at the very heart of our form of government. And that is what Adlai Stevenson was talking about. So that's what popular sovereignty means. And so I'm sorry that you didn't stick with C.
Oh,
no,
me too.
All right. But, Katie, we really appreciate your playing, and you definitely will get a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier.
Great. Thank you.
All right.
You
Thanks
so
for
much.
Playing.
Thanks, Katie.
Okay, bye. Bye-bye.
It's
your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Scott Shane of the New York Times about drones. Now, drones are very controversial, but they have their supporters. And one of the reasons they have supporters is because they enable warfare to occur without as much of what we euphemistically call collateral damage.
And while the levels of civilian casualties in Pakistan are a subject of intense debate, most serious studies have put them somewhere between 3% and 20% of those killed. And that compares favorably to the rough count percentage you get of civilian casualties in other situations. An academic who studied this found that in wars in the last couple decades that the percentage of all casualties that were civilians was somewhere between about 30% and 80%, depending on the place and the estimate. When the Pakistani army went into the Pakistan's tribal areas to try and root out some militants in a couple of areas a couple of years ago, civilian casualties were in the range of 40-50%. So it does appear that drones may be, as logic would tell you, a more precise weapon. I think the among the unanswered questions, among the possible downsides, are that they appear to be radicalizing some portion of the young male Muslim population in some of these countries. And for example, the guy who who tried to blow up a car on Times Square in 2010,
mm-hmm.
in court said that he was motivated to do that by the drone strikes. So, as with so much in the campaign against terrorism, there's this question of whether, what the steps we take to protect ourselves might be inadvertently radicalizing, creating, new terrorists who will attack us in the future. So that's certainly one of the questions.
These things actually start looking, if you take the technology out of the equation for just a moment, if you don't center on all this, these really cool, high-flying, high-tech things that look like they're out of a sci-fi movie, it actually starts looking like a campaign of targeted assassinations. And that troubles a lot of people because at least, before 9/11, we were supposedly out of the assassination business.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very good point. And, there was this flurry of assassination plots carried out by the CIA in the 50s and 60s. Famously, against Fidel Castro, they had plans to poison him with his scuba suit and make his beard fall out and various terrible things. They sent poison toothpaste to try and kill Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, and they sent a poison handkerchief to a guy in Iraq who they thought was leaning communist. And the upshot was basically none of these plots actually killed anyone. They were carried out in a somewhat ham-handed way. And when they were exposed by the Senate's Church Committee in the 70s, I think it's probably fair to say that the general reaction was sort of horror, and President Ford issued an executive order banning assassination. Now, certainly, the Obama administration, the Bush administration would distinguish between assassination as covered by the executive order, which they claim at least had in mind political assassination of political leaders, political figures, versus killing terrorists. They don't see this as political assassination, but as self-defense in a war with Al-Qaeda.
I know that seems like an awfully blurry distinction, though, doesn't it?
Well, it's not the first time. If you remember, after a disco used by American soldiers in Berlin
was bombed,
in the 80s, Reagan ordered the bombing of Tripoli. They traced that bombing supposedly to Libyan intelligence, and they ordered bombing Tripoli, and I believe that Muammar Gaddafi's daughter was killed. Again, under Clinton in 1998, after the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, Clinton ordered cruise missile strikes against a site in Sudan and bin Laden's camp in Afghanistan. So, there is certainly a case that the governments have made, that multiple administrations have made, that those are not assassinations banned by this executive order, but acts of self-defense against terrorists, terrorist strikes, and terrorist plotters. But it does get blurry because in some cases you're talking about heads of state like Gaddafi.
Yeah, it does, and a very, very tough issue. You mentioned a few minutes ago the lost drone, and most of us have not really heard much about that since then, but that was apparently one of our highest high-tech drones, one of our stealth drones, and apparently it went down in Iran, and apparently the Iranians recovered it in some degree of good repair. Have we heard anything about that? How serious is that loss?
Well, I mean, I think they were quite distressed by it. American officials were quite distressed by it. The Iranians claimed that they had hacked it and forced it to land. That's unclear, but I think most American officials believe that something went wrong with it, and it sort of crash-landed. And when the Iranians put it on display, they had a kind of colorful curtain around the bottom of it, which suggested perhaps it was damaged down there. But it was a very, very high-tech stealth drone, and there were reports that the Chinese and Russians and others, you know, were sort of competing to get a look at it, or perhaps even pay money to, you know, get parts. And that
well, I imagine there would be great interest internationally in it, which of course brings up another big issue, is that it's one thing while we've got a monopoly on this stuff to be using it as aggressively as we are. But what happens when other countries inevitably get this technology? What is that? We're setting precedents here. Are we comfortable with these precedents that we're setting?
Well, that's another huge question that that I know is being studied at the State Department right now. You know, I think what the concern is that if the Russians, for example, flew a drone over Georgia, Republic of Georgia, and fired a missile at, say, Chechen rebels, Chechens being, of course, Russian citizens,
mm-hmm.
Who were hiding on the territory of Georgia and who were suspected by Russia of plotting terrorism against Russia, you know, it'd be very interesting to see what we had to say. It's a situation that would be almost exactly parallel to what we're doing in Pakistan. And the Chinese have targeted the Muslim Uyghur minority, some of whom have carried out acts of violence in China. Some of them are hiding in Kazakhstan. So if the Chinese sent a drone over to Kazakhstan to kill some Uyghurs, you know, what would we say? So I think at some point that's going to come to a head, and we'll have to decide whether we're happy or unhappy with the precedent that we set for the rest of the world.
Yep. Well, I see we're running short on time. Before we go, any last thoughts you have, anything you wanted to add?
Well, I guess the only thing is that perhaps the most controversial thing that the Obama administration has done with a drone is kill Anwar al-Awlaki.
A U.S. citizen. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, he's not the only American citizen they've killed, but he is appears to be the only one that they specifically targeted for death, and wrote a long legal memo, which is still secret, to justify. But I think if there's a place where you know, so you sort of run up against a lot of Americans, you know, concerns, it's not so much when you're bumping off members of al-Qaeda in Pakistan, and perhaps not even targeting Anwar al-Awlaki, who was, you know, calling for violence against the U.S., had encouraged violence against the U.S., and according to American intelligence officials, had helped plot that underwear bombing
in Detroit,
the attempt to blow up the plane over Detroit in 2009. So, you know, not many Americans would shed a lot of tears for him. But if you ask, you know, the average person, should the President of the United States have the right to designate an American citizen for killing because he has secret evidence and he's come to believe that person is dangerous, without going to Congress, without going to court, without presenting any evidence anywhere publicly, I think a lot of people say, what, are you crazy? It does seem
very troubling,
like, yeah. an extreme claim, and that has not been. I don't think, you know, we've heard the last of that debate.
No, I suspect we will hear that again and again. But thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us. Thank you very much for keeping tabs on this and keeping the American public informed.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
All right, bye bye.
Bye bye. So long.
Well, thanks very much to Scott Shane of the New York Times, who spoke to us all about drones and some of the significance they have for modern warfare and, of course, for modern politics and modern constitutional law. Let's take a moment now and do our Madison Minute. And then after the break, we'll talk about what's happening this week at Montpelier. And then we'll speak with Benjamin Harris. Stay tuned.
One of the most oft-repeated pieces of Madison lore suggests that Dolly Madison instituted the famous Easter egg roll on the White House lawn. But when the tale appears in print, it is often paired with such qualifying phrases as according to tradition or as the story goes. Unfortunately, there is no period documentation, newspaper accounts, diary entries, letters, or otherwise, to support this claim. Indeed, writers cannot even agree on the location of the inaugural egg roll. Some alleged it happened on the White House lawn, while others insist that the initial celebration took place on the lawn of the Capitol. Unfortunately for Dolly Madison fans, most historians agree that it was much later, during the presidency of Rutherford B. Hayes, that the annual event actually began, when First Lady Lucy Hayes hosted the roll on the White House lawn in April 1878. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
And now let's take a couple of minutes and speak with Sandy Madrinich, who is the head of the grounds at Montpelier, and who's going to tell us what we can do not just this week at Montpelier, but every week. We can always visit Dolly Madison's garden.
And when you're looking around this garden, you see evidence of these, that greater garden, the wonderful trees that really set the stage for everything else you see in here. To the left are the big hollies and the golden arborvitaes. You continue on to the left and you see a magnificent China fir.
That is magnificent. It's just cylindrical. I mean, it's
a perfect Christmas tree.
It's a perfect Christmas tree. That's what mm-hmm. I was trying to say. It really is. It's a beautiful shape.
Well, the DuPonts and primarily all these trees within this garden are
conical. DuPont. That's what I was trying to say. Conical. Okay, now I've got it. Okay, it's a Christmas tree. Okay, go on, please.
When they were going to plant trees, you can imagine they were not picking that last little tree in the nursery, the one that nobody else wanted. They're getting the best specimens to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
They plant them here at Montpelier with that wonderful Davidson soil, and the things flourish, and they grow quicker and faster and better than most plants will. So we're really blessed. Further down, there's southern magnolias, the cedar of Lebanon, which is actually a DuPont tree,
mm-hmm.
a dawn redwood, which we planted in 1990.
That's the conical one there?
Yes.
And that's only 20 years old.
It's only 20 years old.
Wow.
And it's a giant.
It must be, what, 50, 60 feet high?
At least.
Yeah.
And we replaced one that had been there, planted by the DuPonts, that was hit by lightning.
Mm-hmm.
This one has lightning protection now.
Lightning? What, you actually have a lightning rod in it?
There's a copper cable that's inserted or attached to the tree from the tip-top branch all the way down to the ground and out about 20 feet to act as a ground.
I had no idea that trees could have lightning rods.
Use them on more and more of our specimens
here. I had no idea. And it makes great sense. You want to protect something that's that beautiful and that's been growing that long.
We don't want it blasted apart again.
Right.
No,
yeah.
This one is special.
Mm-hmm.
And more southern magnolias, behind which are some tremendous hollies. And back up front here, you have your matching hollies and arborvitaes.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you turn all the way around and look back at the front entrance, you can see that wonderful cedar of Lebanon and the deodar cedar in the front. So those form the frame of our garden. Everything else within it is just the painting that's gone on.
Well, thanks very much to Sandy Madrinich at Montpelier for showing us Dolly Madison's garden. That was lovely. It was pastoral. I love the bird song. But you know what? Enough of that garden stuff. This is an episode about warfare. And we spent a lot of time talking today with Scott Shane of the New York Times about drones and about a lot of the implications of it. One thing that we talked about really caught my ear, and that is that maybe even most of the drone strikes that are occurring right now with U.S. forces are not occurring through the military. They're occurring through the CIA. Now think about that. The CIA is the Central Intelligence Agency, of course, and it's secret. We don't typically debate openly what the CIA is going to do. And if there's any agency that's pretty much completely under the control of the executive, it's the intelligence gathering agencies. And if you're concerned, as many people are, about the constitutional implications and of using these drones, and if we're entering into warfare without having a full and public debate about it, then the CIA drones are arguably more troublesome, more concerning than the ones in the military. And so I've asked young Benjamin Harris, hello Ben.
Hey again.
I have asked young Ben Harris to look into something that came up briefly in my discussions with Scott, and that is the fact that this sort of thing has been going on in a lower-tech version in the CIA for many years, hasn't it, Ben?
Exactly, mainly during the Cold War.
During the Cold War, there were all sorts of black ops or covert operations, as they used to call them. Then, not intelligence gathering, but actually going out and doing nasty things to other countries short of war. And those all came out when?
In the 1975 church hearings.
The church hearings. Okay, what were the church hearings?
Well, after Watergate and the unpopularity of the Vietnam War, Congress really decided it was going to try and rein in President Nixon and the executive branch in general. So after the effectiveness of the Watergate Committee, they tried to create another committee, the official title of which was the U.S. Senate Select Committee to Study Government Operations with Respect to Intelligence Agencies.
Intelligence agencies, yeah.
Or intelligence actions, my
apologies. Intelligence actions, okay, yeah. This was a time of great distrust of government. You know, Richard Nixon really sort of destroyed the general sense of trust that most people had in the presidency. And lots of rumors were circulating. Lots and lots of things were coming out about, you know, secrets in the government. And so I guess this was a reaction to that.
Yes, after an influential New York Times report on all the covert ops that were going on, Congress decided it really had to do something.
Okay, well then what did this church committee do?
Well, unfortunately, it couldn't be as effective as the Watergate committee because most of it had to be by necessity behind closed doors, so it wasn't that public.
So we don't know everything it did.
Well, yeah, actually over 50,000 pages of its research has been declassified.
Oh, so we know a lot of what it did.
Exactly, but its actual official report was 2 feet deep.
2 feet.
Yeah, 2 feet.
You printed it out.
Yeah.
Back in those days, of course, they did print everything out. And it was 2 feet thick. This book, 2 feet thick.
Instead, in the interest of time, what I'll talk about is the interim report, which dealt with the juicy matters of, you know, assassinating foreign leaders.
Okay. Well, then apparently that's what we used to do. Before there were drones, we would use old-fashioned methods, and we would go and try to assassinate foreign leaders. What kind of assassination attempts were made?
Well, the five foreign leaders targeted and mentioned in this report are Patrice Lumumba of the Congo, Fidel Castro of Cuba, Rafael Trujillo of the Dominican Republic, President Diem of Vietnam, and a General René Schneider of Chile.
We tried to kill all those people.
Yeah, and a lot of them ended up dead.
Pray tell, continue.
Well, what's interesting about a lot of these covert ops is how unsuccessful and just, you know, horribly constructed they were. So in the first case, for Patrice Lumumba, the head of the African operations told a field agent.
For the CIA.
Yeah, for the CIA.
Okay.
Received instructions to investigate the possibility of killing this guy. And he, on his own authority, gave poison pills to an agent and instructed him to carry out this assassination.
And Lumumba, this Patrice Lumumba, was just a politician in the Belgian Congo whom we didn't like.
Exactly, whom we disagreed with.
Okay.
But, you know, fortunately for the CIA, in retrospect, somebody else actually killed him before we got to him, because we messed up the first attempt.
Oh, okay. So we were gearing up to kill Lumumba, but didn't quite get there. Okay, but we had the intent.
Yeah, for Rafael Trujillo.
When was Lumumba?
That was actually happened in 1960.
1960, okay, just want to get this in context. All right.
The next year, in 1961, we attempted to kill a politician in the Dominican Republic, a dictator. Hmm. And we actually tried to use dissidents within his own country to do that, and they began clamoring for arms and munitions, all of which the CIA was happy to supply. Eventually, his car was actually ambushed. And he was killed with small weapons fire. Later, the CIA denied that those were the weapons it gave to the Dominican militants. But, I mean, here's a guy who died in a plot very similar to what the CIA constructed. So you have to be curious as to what were the actual facts regarding his death.
Okay, so that's two.
The third was President Diem in Vietnam. He was the president of South Vietnam. And he was an unpopular president that the United States was tired of. We were supporting his regime, and we wanted to stop. So what the CIA did is it sponsored a coup led by South Vietnamese generals to overthrow Diem. And it, the CIA claimed it did not know this was going to happen, but the generals actually executed Jim and killed him. The CIA just thought he was going to be made prisoner or exiled or something. That's what they claimed,
okay.
And that was in 1963.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1970 is perhaps the most interesting case, because Salvador Allende just received a plurality in the Chile presidential elections.
Okay, so down in Chile.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And Allende was a Marxist. He was a socialist, but he was popularly elected in fair elections. But Nixon instructed the CIA, this is from the president himself, saying that Allende should not be allowed to assume power because his ideology was wrong.
Okay, let me get this straight now. Nixon doesn't say, go down there and find out about Salvador Allende. He says, he's not going to be president.
Exactly.
See to it. Who will rid me of this man?
He pretty much gives the CIA open discretion. So uh-huh. They go down there and they try and stage a military coup. Unfortunately, there's one of the chief generals, General René Schneider, says, I'm not going to participate in these things.
Unfortunately for Nixon.
The CIA, Nixon. And he says, no, I believe in, constitutional government. This guy was elected president, so it's my duty to let him assume power. So the CIA said, okay, we need to get rid of this guy, and attempted to try and kidnap him.
Kidnap Schneider.
Exactly.
Okay, so you get a Chilean general who's approached by the CIA to help overthrow a democratically elected president.
Or indirectly approached, but yeah.
Okay, and he says, no, I'm going to support my country's constitution. So our response is, okay, now we got to get rid of the general.
Pretty much, okay. From the, stronghold of Western democracy. So we actually fail twice to kidnap him, the CIA does. And then another faction down in Chile tries to kidnap him and ends up killing him in the kidnapping attempt.
Right.
So again, the CIA failed, but somebody else did the dirty work.
Wow. Okay. And that one you often hear of because, again, I think the fact that Nixon so directly, effectively just ordered the CIA to kill somebody really struck a lot of people as executive power run amok. I mean, you can look as hard as you want to in Article 2 of the Constitution, and you're not going to find any grant of authority, no license to kill that's given to the president, outside, of course, of the context of being commander-in-chief in times of war, and that there was no war.
Yeah, and what makes this even worse is, though a military coup didn't happen that time and Allende assumed power, 3 years later, the military did launch a coup, and killed Allende.
And so eventually Nixon got him.
Exactly. Well, the CIA claims it had no involvement in the later coup, but they at least planted the seeds there. And guess who became in charge of Chile? Oh, yeah, that'd be General Pinochet, one of the worst dictators. Brutally repressive, murdered millions of people, not millions of people, but a lot of people.
A lot of people, yeah. In fact, wasn't he recently brought up on war crimes or crimes against humanity charges?
Yeah.
Recently, within the last few years. And oh, boy. Okay.
But I'd have to say the most interesting plots by the CIA occurred against Fidel Castro. And these are the own commission described these plots as using devices which strain the imagination.
So the Church Committee was saying that they didn't believe what they had discovered.
Yeah, it's just it's absolutely ludicrous if you look at it. For example, the first attempt, they actually took cigars that Castro was fond of and tried to poison them and send them back to Castro. They gave an aide close to Castro who was working with the CIA a pen which had a hypodermic needle with poison for injection. They had an idea floating around to rig a seashell to explode. A seashell, yeah. That was too extreme even for them. They didn't actually go through with that.
What were you going to send it to him as a gift? Seashell, and don't look at it too closely? Or what?
He went strolling on the beach, and they thought they could rig it to explode while he was there.
Okay, like an exploding starfish.
Between 1960 and 1965, there are no fewer than 8 CIA attempts to knock off Castro, all of which were horrible failures.
I see.
Maybe the most serious of which was actually an attempt to use the mob in America with connections to Cuba.
The mafia,
uh-huh. To kill Castro. And what made this interesting is one of the people they turned to help them with this, Sam Giancana, was on the top 10 most wanted criminal list for the Attorney General in the United States. And so instead of handing him over to the Attorney General, the CIA kept all of the secret and instead used him in one of their harebrained schemes to sneak poison pills into Castro.
And that didn't work either.
No, apparently he stopped going to the restaurant they had a man planted in.
Apparently so. Well, that does. It sounds like one of those assassination attempts you'd see in one of those mob movies in The Godfather. You know, poisoning someone's food, or putting in the cannolis, or something of that sort, or sneaking in and you know, killing someone with the eyeglasses. You know, it sounds like one of those movies.
Well, in The Godfather, they probably could have pulled it off.
The Corleones were a bit more effective than the CIA, I guess. Fascinating history. Low-tech history, the way we used to take out foreign leaders. Now, of course, we take out people we don't like with other means, unmanned aerial vehicles. Anything else you want to tell us about the old days and the way we used to do things?
Just to remark, it's at least much more effective today. You can't deny that.
It is much more effective today if you compare it with warfare. But is it any different than what we used to do before we had drones?
It's the exact same concept, you know, taking somebody out without much civilian debate, which is the main issue most people have with this. We've never even debated going to war with these countries, but yet we're, you know, systematically taking out military targets within them.
All right. Well, Benjamin Harris, thank you very much for giving us a bit of historical perspective. And thanks very much to Scott Shane of the New York Times for talking to us about drones and their modern implications. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.
I moved out to Langley recently with a plain and simple dream. Wanna infiltrate some third world place and topple their regime. Those men in black with their mansion suitcases, where everything's on a need-to-know basis. Agents got that swagger, everyone's so cloak and dagger. I'm feeling nervous, but I'm really kinda wishing for an undercover mission. That's when the red alert came on the radio, and I put my earpiece on. Got my dark sunglasses on, and I had my like, yeah, shredding the files like, yeah. I memorized all the enemy spies. I gotta neutralize today. Yeah, it's a party in the CIA. Yeah, it's a party in the CIA. I've done a couple of crazy things that have almost gotten me dismissed. Like terminate some head of state who wasn't even on my list. Burn that microfilm, buddy, will you? I tell you why, but then I'd have to kill you. You need a quickie confession? We'll start a waterboarding session. No hurry on this South American dictator. I'll assassinate him later. That's when he walked right in my laser sights. And my silencer was on. And my silencer was on. And another target's gone. Yeah, we got a flag up all over the world. From Kazakhstan to Bombay. Paying the bribes like, yeah. Plugging the leaks like, yeah. Interrogating the scum of the earth. We'll break them by the break of day. Yeah. It's a party in the CIA. Yeah. It's a party in the CIA. Need a country to stabilize. Stabilize. Look no further. We're your guy. We're your guy. Got snazzy suits and ties, suits and ties, and a better dental plan than the FBI's. Better put your hands up and get.